National Council of Jewish Women, Pittsburgh Section, Oral History Number 2. My name is Bernice Herzog. My respondent's name is Edgar Michaels. This is Wednesday, April the 8th, 1992. Edgar, will you tell me about the religious views of your grandparents and parents, either here or in Europe?
My maternal grandparents came from the village of Ostrog in Russia, which was really on the Polish border. Some question about whether my heritage is Russian or Polish is, my mother tells me, dependent upon who had the stronger army in the vicinity at that time. They were typical of the Jewish family that lived in the small shtetl in the Jewish Pale, immigrated to this country in the late 1800s. Grandfather came first, bringing the eldest son, and they were carpenters and worked for the Pittsburgh Railway System, which were then wooden trolley cars and obviously needed carpenters to keep them in good repair.
Do you know anything about your grandparents' religious views?
Yes, they were Orthodox Jews and traditionally belonged to the local synagogue. Grandfather was an active, heavily involved in the synagogue, was a man who put on the tefillin each day and observed Jewish dietary customs.
How about your parents' religious views?
My father was not a practicing Jew when he married my mother, but enjoyed the family and felt keenly aware of Judaism, and changed his mind, and in fact recanted and became an active Jew himself. Mother and Dad felt more comfortable in conservative practice, and we lived on the north side while I was growing up in the Beth Israel congregation. On East Street was a conservative synagogue where we actively participated in the rituals of the synagogue and, of course, attended the Sunday school and Hebrew school. Dad was a treasurer of the congregation for many years. Mother was president of the sisterhood for many years.
Were you bar mitzvahed from the East Street Synagogue?
Yes, I was, and also confirmed from the Sunday school.
And did you have to wear a tallis, or did the men wear a tallis?
Men wore a tallis. And, I have to admit that the synagogue served many members of the Northside community who were extremely Orthodox. Everybody felt comfortable in the synagogue, regardless of their feelings about Judaism.
You mentioned that your father had a store on Northside. As a young man, did you work in his store, and what were your experiences there?
It was hard, very hard not to work in the store. We lived upstairs in an apartment above the store, so family life and operations in the store were virtually one and the same. If you were one of the earlier diners, then obviously it was your responsibility to go down and relieve another member of the family so they could come up and eat. Since mother obviously prepared the meals, the responsibility of exchanging responsibilities of who watched the store fell to my brother, my father, or me, as the occasion occurred.
Did you think of it as a chore or something that you wanted to do?
Well, needless to say, as a child, certainly there were a lot of ball games you'd rather have been involved in than working in the store. But it was a happy life. It was a small community. Actually, it was a community called Troy Hill that was kind of in an enclave all of its own. Everybody knew each other, everybody else. There were very strong ethnic pockets, primarily German, but there were also some Croatians as well.
And you were saying there were other things that you would like to have done, like play ball. Were you athletically inclined and when you were younger, or did you play the street games that other kids did, or was your time taken up in work?
No, we did it all. In fact, one summer went to the Irene Kaufman Settlement Camp and really didn't understand that at all, because I realized then that I was at camp all summer long at home. We went to use the local playground, we used the city swimming pool, we had hills and trees to climb and ball games. If you didn't want to go to the playground, we played on the streets, and it was a pleasant pleasant life growing up. Obviously, sports were an important part of it, and we participated after school and whatever the game of the season was.
Are you still interested in sports, and do you play any?
Well, I play at them. I'm not good at it, but I do enjoy golf. And when we're on vacation, I play a little tennis, a friendly game of doubles, including my wife and other couples. But I was not a great athlete. I can't say that I really was. However, having spent so many hours participating in the Northside playgrounds and streets, I could hold my own among most groups, and was kind of surprised when I got into the service or I went to college that I could certainly make the intramural team without much trial.
In high school, did you participate in any of the sports?
No, I never. High school actually was a good distance from our home. Participating in a team sport was a little inconvenient and was not really my cup of tea. I enjoyed more of the sandlot without the disciplines, and played sandlot ball for the most part.
When you first entered Pitt, what was your major, and what were your dreams of after graduation?
My interests were always in industry and business. I had been able to achieve whatever scholastic requirements were, and I only can tell you this story. My mother said to me when I entered high school that she had had the experience of attending many of her nieces and nephews' graduations, and she recalled that the graduating class sat on the stage, and there were about a half a dozen children that sat out front, and those children managed to say something during the course of the ceremony, and she said, just be one of those six kids. And that was the only direction. That's the only direction I got. The rest was really left up to me. I kind of admired that I was left on to my own devices and tried to pass on the same kind of discipline to my own children, saying, that's your responsibility, that's your job, you do it, and we're not going to discuss it much at all. And my children followed, and I was happy to say, carried out the dictum.
Tell us about your Air Force days, your training, some of the good men that you met as officers.
I was, when war broke out in December of 41, I was 18 and a half years old, had about a little less than a year in it at the University of Pittsburgh, having begun in a winter semester. And it was apparent that even then, although before war broke out, that obviously the scourge of Adolf Hitler was on us, and as Jews, you were very much concerned with the plight of European Jews, and that there was no doubt that America would have to participate in the war if, in fact, the free world was to be saved. Obviously, we were not a militaristic family, but it became apparent that joining an ROTC unit made good sense, and I did that when I entered into Pitt. Didn't particularly like the military or the ground forces, and so when war was declared, I immediately signed up for the Air Force and decided I'd rather fly than walk.
Ed, you mentioned that you were shot down. Could you describe to us your life living with your, let's call them, benefactors? And tell us about that time in your life.
Having entered in the Air Force and going through the Aviation Cadet Program, I then was commissioned and my particular military specialty was aerial navigation, was assigned to a bomber crew, and then entered the European Theater of Operations. Spent a little bit of time of training and doing some reconnaissance work in Ireland, and then moved to a combat group in England, part of the 8th Air Force. Was assigned, along with the rest of the crew who had trained together in the United States, to a B-24 combat group. We represented the typical American crew. I think the eldest member of our group was 24 years old. I was, when I first started to fight combat, was less than 21 years old, celebrated my 21st birthday in a combat situation. We flew missions over the industrial centers of Germany, and did some specialty bombing of critical sites that would have been occupied by the Germans in France. It was on such a mission on an airfield in eastern France that our plane was shot down on a summer afternoon in August 1944. The plane had been hit by anti-aircraft fire, and we had a runaway engine which we were unable to stop, and it would have then caused the propeller to sever from the engine and would have cut the plane obviously in half. And so under that circumstance, we were left with no other action but to bail out. We were a crew of 10 people. All the men were able to get out alive, and in fact were able to, through whatever means, remain alive until such time as the Americans overtook the area where we were, whether we were in an underground movement or captured or in a hospital or whatever. It was my good fortune to land in a rural area. Actually, it was a farm country. I had been wearing a new issue of a special kind of rubber boot over an electric flying suit that apparently had not been battle tested, because the first thing that happened to me when I left the aircraft is that the boots flew off my feet. And I had made my mind up that since I was Jewish, that I certainly was not going to jump out of an airplane at 18,000 feet and open up a propeller at 2 o'clock on a summer afternoon and spend the next half hour reaching the ground and have 100 German soldiers there to greet me. So I had read about something called a free fall that said reasonably the fastest you can fall is 120 miles an hour. So I felt that I could take that for a while and then would open my chute at the last possible moment with the anticipation under that circumstances perhaps I could evade capture, which is what I did. So that by the time I opened my chute, I didn't have much choice of where I was going to land, but spawned a spot that looked relatively open and surrounded by some woods. However, at the last minute, I found that somebody had gone in there and chopped down the trees but left all the stumps. So I landed in bare feet virtually with just a soft electric thing like a slipper on my foot into these stumps, and wound up with some damage to my left ankle that probably was some broken bones. And after I composed myself, I said, well, I have to find a way out of this. So I made myself a cane out of a tree bough and headed to the outside of this. And when I did, and I left the surrounding little forest, I realized I was in farm country and looked up on a hill and saw a solitary man standing there who saw me, and I saw him, and then the man vanished. I had nowhere to go, really, but stood there and kind of tried to decide what my next move would be, and very soon thereafter, a small boy appeared on a two-wheel bicycle and motioned to me to seat myself on the bicycle. Together, we pushed the bike back toward an abandoned barn, where he made me know that I was to seclude myself and just rest. Before very long, an adult appeared. This man spoke English. It so happens that apparently he was a member of an aristocracy and was in fact the landowner of those farms, who told me in fairly good English that he was not a member of the underground movement, but he did know people in it, and that he would advise them of my situation. He assured me that it was very dangerous for me to remain where I was, because I not only was endangering myself, but was endangering the lives of the friendly farmers. So shortly thereafter, and it was now approaching nightfall, a couple of men appeared and moved me on a carriage to another site. This was apparently another farm nearby, where I remained until early morning, and I was given a set of civilian clothes, dressed in civilian clothes, and taken by horse-drawn carriage, pretending I was one of the villagers, through the village into another site that was several miles away. At this site were members of the underground, who then were my saviors and supporters until such time as I was able to be united with the American troops, which was some 7 weeks later.
What kind of friends did you make among the civilians of that village?
Actually, not only was my own life in danger, but any contact that I would have made with any civilian would have placed them at extreme risk. The men who were members of the Maquis, as it was called, the French underground, were not of that same region, because if they were and were captured, they would have put their own families in severe risk of torture, death, or whatever. So they themselves were not members of that community, and while they had the support of members of the community, they secluded us and would not, until such time as it was less dangerous. By less dangerous, I mean that there were now American troops in the vicinity. This was in the summer of 44. This was after Patton had made his landing in southern France and was moving across France at a rather rapid pace. There was a time when there was obviously the exchange of the German line with the American line. We were united with Patton's forces.
You told us before about how your parents raised you. Could you tell me now about where your children went to school and how you raised them, and what do you see in contrast?
We raised our children in the Point Breeze section of Pittsburgh. Our children went to Sterrett Public School, where went to Taylor Alderdice. From Taylor Alderdice, our eldest, our daughter, went to Northwestern and graduated from Northwestern School of Speech, received her master's degree at the University of Michigan. Our sons, who are twins, who are 3 years younger than their sister, went to the University of Pennsylvania. Both sons did. The question was, should twin sons go to the same school or not? The decision was that each child is entitled to make up his own mind as to where he went to school. By happenstance, it was the same school as his brother. He would not be denied that privilege because he had a brother going to the same school. And they visited fine schools. They were good students, had good SATs, and had some choices. And strangely enough, both boys decided that they wanted to go to the University of Pennsylvania, so both boys went to the same school. Some of that time they roomed together, some of the times they roomed with others. They came to the conclusion later on that they were used to each other's bad habits, so they'd rather room with each other than to have roommates with new bad habits. So, graduating from the University of Pennsylvania, they went to George Washington Law School in Washington, D.C., and have remained in the Washington, D.C. area. And our daughter, after graduation from Michigan Graduate School, married Edward Rubinoff, who had also gone to the George Washington School of Law and had taken a job with a Washington law firm. So all three of our children reside in the Washington, D.C. area, specifically in Potomac, Maryland. It's rather nice to have three children all living in the same suburban community. Makes our visit to the children and grandchildren a lot easier and much more pleasant as far as their religious education. The children all went to Rhoda Sholem. Our sons were probably the first twins to have been bar mitzvahed from Rhoda Sholem, since bar mitzvah in their day and age was new at the congregation. A daughter as the sons were confirmed there as well. Their recognition of Judaism is patterned differently than ours was. They attended school where they were part of an academia that did not differentiate. There was not near the bias, and so their social friends tended to be both Jews and Christians alike. Our daughter is married to a Jew. Our two sons are married to women who were born as Roman Catholics. We're pleased to say that we can honestly say we do enjoy our in-law children, whether they be Jewish or non-Jewish. We are proud of them, the children that they have born. And I do believe we are a happy family and have adjusted to a situation that once encountered with is fraught with a lot of second guessing and some feeling that perhaps you haven't carried out your mission. But whatever it is, I think it's important that the family unit remain intact. It has remained so, I'm pleased to say. And I think we are a well-knit family and a well-adjusted family, coming from different backgrounds, but I think we're willing to accept that. Identify our differences, and we do not have extensive religious discussion, but we're pleased to say that our daughters-in-law do join us for the High Holy Days and do participate in the service. We would hope that our grandchildren would be raised Jewish, if that's the proper term. I think it's part of the American experience that intermarriage does take place. Who knows what the outcome may well be. In fact, that what we look at as an attack or some less Jewishness, it may in fact be something that will expand and reduce the amount of hatred and anti-Semitism, because we won't be such a pure group any longer. We will know who isn't Jewish and who is Jewish before it's all over.
What was a contrasting period or idea between your children's upbringing and your upbringing? What is the contrast?
Having lived in a non-Jewish community, it may very well be that it's easier for me to accept non-Jewish people. These were my childhood playmates. The question about whether I would marry a non-Jew, I'm sure my mother many times over reminded me of my heritage and my responsibility. While I was going to school, there's no question I dated both Jewish and non-Jewish girls. And somehow, though when it came time to choose, I did choose a Jewish girl. Costly teased my mother about the fact that while these were lovely women, that very often their choice of jewelry, they would make the mistake of wearing a cross, and somehow that was seemed like my mother almost was watching over as